I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to this very special Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best? Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Now, it's special not only because the sun has been shining in London for what seems like the first time in weeks or maybe even months, but because we're also delighted to welcome John Watson. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Nick.
Now, John, as you may know, is a five-time Grand Prix winner with Penske, Brabham and McLaren, a sports car racer with Jaguar, Porsche and Toyota. And if you'll permit me, John, one of the finest racing commentators there is. So we'll start off with a pleasantry and just to get you into the right mood of this podcast. Also joining us today, we have Simon Aaron, our features editor here.
Okay.
And the newly promoted digital editor. So it's Jack Phillips here to join us today as well. Now, John, I'm going to start with your last podcast, actually, 2009.
You're going to say about Kimi Räikkönen lying in the gutter spewing up his what?
Oh, no, actually, it does actually refer to Kimi.
That, I know that got a massive reaction.
It's not. It kind of relates to Kimi. So you said Kimi should take a sabbatical and that more oil-rich states would be hosting Formula One Grand Prix. So the first thing, can I have your lottery numbers? That's the first thing. And secondly, what makes you so good at predicting or proposing what motor racing is or what it needs?
I think sometimes, I mean, I'm not a sage. I don't know things that other people, more people in sport, would certainly have knowledge of. I trust intuition, instinct, and you know, I suppose maybe much of my life has been guided by those two values. So I'll have a lot of rants and shoot from the lip and the hip and whatever. And just sometimes one of them, one out of 10 or one out of 20 might hit the mark. Otherwise, maybe so far off the radar that no one ever picks them up.
Okay, I'm going to wind us all the way back now. So the TT at Dundrod. I'm fascinated by this because you were stood there as a kid watching Fangio and the other greats. Tell me this was the seminal moment for you, was it? This moment watching these greats scream by in your home. Tell me more about this time.
Well, first of all, the Tourist Trophy race, the oldest race I think in the British calendar, and at this period it was being run on the Dundrod circuit just outside Belfast, very near to the airport. Was called Nuts Corner, which is quite appropriate when you consider anybody that drove a Dundrod probably had to be a bit of a nut, because it is and still is, and I say this now even in whatever date we are in August, it about 90% of that original racetrack is still, it's a time capsule. And it's a great shame that maybe the tourist authorities in Northern Ireland or the local governments, whatever, have not seen to make more of it. It's an asset that's sitting there crying out to get recognised and used. And when you think about all the events that take place around Europe, and I just competed this year in the Mille Miglia retrospective. Okay, you can't do 1,000 laps of Dendrod, but or 1,000 miles of Dendrod, but the circuit. And if anybody ever goes to Northern Ireland and flies into Nut's Corner, or as it's now known better as Aldergrove, drive around what is 90% or so of the original racetrack, you will be shocked, because it's a brilliant, brilliant racetrack. But in the paddock in 1955, I think it was 9 years of age, my family were friendly with Ron Flockhart, and Ron was racing in what was one of the MGAs, the factory MGAs. I think they may have had one of them or two of them with the twin cam engine that went into the MGA at a later date. And Ron, I believe, or from memory, was staying with us over that weekend. So in the paddock and looking around and just seeing, just, you know, maybe it was the cars initially, but then realizing that you had the top drivers in the world competing in a round of the World Sports Car Championship. And one of the things I'm going to bang on about, what a contrast to the sham that we have at Le Mans, where Le Mans in the 50s may have been one of the greatest, if not the greatest race, because of people. And it's people that make events. Technology and cars embrace it, enhance it, but it's people. And seeing those drivers and having Juan Manuel Fangio, who's been my hero, Stirling Moss, Mike Hawthorn, Peter Collins, I can't remember all the names, but all the top drivers in the world at that time, certainly in sports car and Formula One, were competing. And it just was like, I couldn't believe it, that I was there amongst them. I think from memory, I did get a Mike Hawthorn autograph.
Did you? Wow.
I don't know where it is now, but...
Yeah. Probably on eBay, isn't it?
No, it's not. I think I enhanced it with green ink when I was a schoolboy to make it look more impressive. But it just those... And I think that's what's lacking, maybe in motorsport in general, that everybody is polarized into one aspect of their form, of their careers. It was a dream, just... You know, children have dreams, and I think children, and I'm speaking as somebody who's not a parent, but had the benefit of having parents who allowed me to have these dreams. The difference was, at that point, I don't think my family ever considered that my dream would ever be something I could go on and fulfill, but they allowed me to have it. We had a family motor business, and that was the direction I was being directed towards. So I had these dreams, and all the way through my adolescence and childhood, and then when I started to race as a family affair in 1964, it was an extension of what my father had done. And instead of us supporting my father, then my family were supporting me. But it was club racing in Ireland, both north and south, and it was competitive in its own field. But the prospect of somebody at that point moving into the international motorsport field was very rare. I mean, there had been one or two who had done so, notably Desmond Titterington in the 50s, and Desmond could have been certainly a Grand Prix driver. I know he drove a number of Formula One races, and he was a great sports car driver. But Desmond, I think through family issues, decided to hang up his helmet in a time when motorsport was dangerous. And then one or two others had competed, and probably Paddy Hobkirk would be notable in the early 60s, not so much as a rally driver, but as a race driver. And on it went. But I think then when I moved forward in 1970, I was the first driver who consciously set out on a career to compete in a European championship and had aspirations to be a Grand Prix driver. So it all, I suppose, stemmed from what I saw in the paddock at Dendrod. But there's something else I saw in the paddock at Dendrod. It was the beginning of a love affair. And that was the first time I ever saw a Porsche in life, both a 356 Coupe and a 550 Spider. And something about the look of the car, the sound of the car, the fact that this was the little guy, you know, outperforming some of the big guys. And from that point forward, that was the mark that I supported and fundamentally have bought into.
Yeah, okay.
Can I just ask you to expand upon a couple of words in an answer and a half ago? Le Mans and sham. Why are you so sort of against the way Le Mans is at the moment?
I'll say two things. two words. One is Alonso and one is Indianapolis. When Fernando Alonso set off to do his adventure or take part in his adventure, the amount of global interest in the event Indianapolis 500 went up, I don't know what percentage, it went up massively. Yeah. And it just indicated that the power of the person, the personality, the character, the driver, the world champion is way greater than unbelievably stupid, expensive, complex vehicles which run around. In this year's Le Mans, there were five of them. Forget about Colin Cullers' car because it wasn't a hybrid car in the sense of Porsche and Toyota. And the reason I say it is because I remember Le Mans as a child. I remember listening to it on radios. And when I was at boarding school, you know, the radio would be little transistors. We barely get any volume out of it to listen to the reports coming through every hour, 3 hours, whatever. And there were all, I think, the principal names of the race drivers, Grand Prix drivers, IndyCar drivers, not even some cases probably NASCAR drivers, competing. And I think that Le Mans has lost vision as to what makes their race such a special event. They're focused on this hybrid technology, which is very interesting for engineers and very interesting maybe for Le Mans because there are side benefits which I understand they enjoy. But as far as the public is concerned, I think they want to see names that they are familiar with. And while there are many great names that currently compete at Le Mans, wouldn't it be wonderful if some of the Alonsos or the Hamiltons or the Vettels competed? Now, Mark Webber did compete. Mark was just one of a very few that have, you know, stopped Formula One and moved in. But I would like to see a field of what would be the top drivers in any field, be it IndyCar, NASCAR, Formula One, all go to Le Mans. Because that's what I think the public are interested in. And that's why I think the direction that they've gone in with this high-tech, you know, expensive, one race, once a year, only one team can win it. I wonder why Porsche have decided to stop.
I think Formula One doesn't help itself. And it does restrict all of its drivers to purely doing Formula One. Obviously, Hülkenberg was the exception. So maybe there isn't the interest from the Formula One drivers now to do Le Mans like there used to be.
I think that is pretty much the case. And I have said that if I had been Alonso's boss, I wouldn't have let him do it because I would want to protect my interest. But maybe the future for motorsport is to be a little bit less sort of insular and understand that what's going to make the sport grow further is really public interest and public support. And by being isolationist, maybe you're going to lose some of your fan base. And I think the message that, and whether I was right or wrong, my view is that I wouldn't have let them do it. But the point that I think is that the support and the interest globally in Alonso going and competing in Indy was, I just thought, unbelievable. And there is something there to be registered with Formula One teams in particular. Maybe this very precious approach that has been adopted since really the end of the 70s, early 80s, might need to be revisited.
I think you just got to look at the numbers watching the live stream of Alonso practicing on his own.
I did it. I was one of those
exactly.
people.
We were in the office.
Almost every screen in the office was tuned in. We realised after about 2 minutes we're all doing the same
thing. But Simon, it was because you wanted to wait and see when that Honda engine blew up. You weren't interested in the driver. All you wanted to see was the bad side of the story. But the good news is the power of the personality. And that has always been, I think, sport is always about people. It's not about, I mean, I watch test match cricket, largely because I like Sky's coverage and I like the interaction between the various experts. But I don't want to know about the stitching on the cricket ball, whether it's hand, knit one, purl one, knit one, purl one. I want to know about what a bowler is going to do to a batsman. And I think that Formula One has gone down this avenue, as other aspects of motorsport have done, Le Mans particularly, of extreme technology. It's unbelievably clever. It's not going to save the world, but it might help some of the directions toward where we might want to go to. But it isn't what the public actually, I believe, want to watch. They want to be entertained. They want to see competition. They don't want to see a race of five cars over a 24-hour period, in my view.
You commentate nowadays on the Blancpain GT series. Very successful. 55, 60 car grids, GT3 cars. Massive diversity among manufacturers. Some high-quality drivers. Cars look great, sound great. Would you actually like to see Le Mans become a GT race? Get rid of the prototypes altogether. I know there's a political thing now because the WEC GT rules are slightly different to GT3 rules and so on. But do you think that would be a good answer?
Well, I would in one sense, because I think that that's where Le Mans began, because the cars that raced Le Mans when it was in its introduction were fundamentally road-going cars. So on the other hand, of course, the Spa 24-hour race, which was the last, was the biggest race in the Blancpain calendar, it would have a bearing on that. So the Blancpain 24 is a GT race. Le Mans is a race made up of four separate categories. But in some respects, yes, I would like to see that kind of revision to what Le Mans is trying to achieve. And I went to Le Mans in 1963, 64. Which was the first year of the GT40s there? Was it
63? 65, wasn't it?
No, 64. Okay, and in that you had clearly recognisable, you know, Sunbeam Alpines, MGBs, Triumph Spitfires, Austin Healeys, Porsche Aboth, Porsche Carrera. No, they didn't have the Aboth in those days. They might have done. Certainly 904s, that was the Aboth was pre that. 904 Porsche, whatever else. And some of those cars were not quite road cars. Some of them, certainly in the GT categories, were very closely aligned to road cars. And what you have now is GT AM, which is the pro version, and the amateur version. But you've got a plethora of LMP2 cars, which I actually wanted an LMP2 car to win this year, to make the point. Absolutely. To make the point that this technology, while it's extremely exciting for the manufacturers and the side benefits to the organization because they get support from those manufacturers, what about the public? What about the people that go and pay their money to watch? What about I don't know how many people around the world might have watched the feeds. But it is interesting, and I think it's something that should not go unnoticed, that in the UK, which is very supportive of Formula One, the amount of interest principally in the newspapers, I know that Motorsport supports Le Mans very, very heavily, but in newspapers, well, when Nick Tandy won last year, you got about that much coverage. And I believe, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe that the race has become so far removed from what the public are interested in. Make a formula that is maybe less complex. Find a way to get more Formula One teams or IndyCar teams or whatever to release their drivers to compete and return the race to its proper status.
There were a number of IndyCar drivers, but then they don't get the big seats. They get the GT seats, so they'll be in the four GTs. That's comprised of mainly IndyCar drivers.
Yeah, but Scott Dixon would, you know, for example, probably the finest driver in America in single-seater racing. I mean, if you put him into an LMP1 Toyota or Porsche, he'd be up there with the best of the drivers.
I think the American model is possibly the way to go for Le Mans, because...
Well, the DPs.
Yeah, because you can open it to anyone. Any drivers can go, and the teams can employ whoever they really want.
Yeah.
And that's the way I would go, personally.
I mean, it's been one view that's been expressed, and... What Le Mans will do, Le Mans will only do what's good for Le Mans, I believe, as opposed to what the public might want. But DP is one way, and it certainly would bring the cost base down by a substantial margin.
And there's manufacturers.
Yes, I mean, you've got branding on them. I mean, who's running it now? Mazda going to run with
Yost.
Honda's coming in with Roger Penske.
Mazda with
Cadillac.
Nissan.
You got the names. But ultimately, I don't think the names should be greater than the drivers, and I think it's the drivers that should be the foundation of any championship, and the manufacturers should be there as the bridesmaid, but never quite the bride.
Well, let's go back to the power of personalities, the phrase you used just now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bounce back to your career, and then we'll come back to modern stuff as well. So the power of personality, Easter Monday 1969, you went up against Jochen Rindt and Jackie Stewart. Did you feel at that point that you could beat these guys? How was your confidence in the car?
I suppose it was a journey into the unknown, because a colleague in Northern Ireland, Jerry Kinnane, had purchased the two Lotus 48s, and we turned up at Thruxton, and we didn't drive the car until I got there, and John Pollock was the driver in the second car, and we went out and practiced, and we had some issues, and eventually we got a set of Autolite champion plugs, and that fixed the misfire, for example. But during the course of the race, I found myself catching and overtaking people that I used to read about, which was slightly surreal experience, but I wasn't doing anything that was different to that I had done competing in the events that I was racing in Northern Ireland. And it made me maybe appreciate better that actually maybe I had sufficient ability to compete against named drivers and catch and overtake some of them, and that there was a possibility with family support, because there was no commercial support at that time, to have an opportunity to go and race in Formula 2. Initially, what we had thought about doing in 1970 was actually doing a Formula 3 season, and then we changed and went and bought the BT30 to compete in the European Formula 2 Championship. So, in a sense, that was both the foundation of my dream becoming a reality, and almost my parents having to come to terms with the fact that, well, our son, who we support and provide and whatever, actually has a career of his own that he wants to fulfill and follow. And I was very lucky to have the family and support from my family to let me do that.
Did a piece on Formula 2 in the magazine a couple of months ago, and you kindly contributed.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely image you gave me talking about that season. I mean, just travelling, you and a mechanic, just the two of you, van, trailer.
Yeah.
Travelling around, and you made the comparison at the time of, you know, guys like Lance Stroll that have no idea what that was all about. Well, what were some of the highlights of that year, you and your mechanic touring Europe together?
I mean, obviously, the first race at Thruxton in 1970, on the front row of the grid with, actually, in that case, it was Jochen Rindt and Jackie Eakes. You know,
wow.
It's a bit strange to find yourself...
Well, the concept of a three-car front row is quite strange nowadays.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I mean, remember, these cars are quite small by the standards of today. It all got set into perspective by going to Hockenheim. And I'd never raced in a circuit like Hockenheim with these long straights, no chicanes, and slipstring. No wings, from memory. So I thought that I had the ability to lap quicker driving on my own, as opposed to slipstreaming, and of course I didn't qualify. And I went, you know, and Brian Hart, whose workshops I was keeping my car in, had given me, you know, some advice, but I thought I knew better. So I didn't get slipstreaming in those qualifying sessions, and consequently didn't qualify. So that put things back into perspective. And then I think the race that followed that was in Barcelona on the Montjuïc Park.
Proper bus,
that is, without hesitation, question, or whatever contradiction, the best street circuit I've ever raced on. Magnificent. Every element that you'd want in a proper road track. And sometimes, I know racing drivers shouldn't have favorite circuits. They're meant to be professional. They're meant to just take emotion out and just perform. But Montjuïc Park, I just thought was fantastic. Loved it. So that was another high. And then, you know, ended up we got to Rouen, when coming up the other side of the valley, and there's a very fast right-hand corner onto the autobahn or autoroute or whatever they call it in France. And I didn't realize that I had a left rear tire had been deflating. So I just midway through the corner, and the tire and the rim parted company, and I went off and hit the barriers, you know, heavily on both sides. And that was the end of the 1970 season. So that was the final reality check. The reaction being, no one told me you can get hurt. Because when you're young, you think you're probably not necessarily, you know, consciously think you get on hurt, but you always believe that it's never going to happen to you. And it could have been. That could have been a much more serious accident than it turned out. Nevertheless, it took me out of the season, or took me out of the rest of the season.
But it didn't deter you from jumping back in a car as soon as you could?
Maybe I wasn't bright enough to recognize that.
You still didn't realise you could get hurt.
You couldn't realise you get hurt. It does change you. Once you realise, once you've been injured, I think there is a change within your approach. And what you do is maybe, instead of tackling every issue head on, every corner head on, every competitor head on, you look for possibilities to give yourself an escape route. I think that's the difference between having a big accident and getting injured. Over time, that consequence sort of reduces, but certainly I think in the early days you're more conscious of the fact that if you go off here you could get seriously hurt.
So 1971, the glamour of Bognor, And I was also interested to read that George Brown is one of your unsung heroes.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about George, and our readers and listeners may not know about him?
Well, George, I met George in 1970 when he worked with Church Farm Racing with Derek Bell and Mike Earle. And at the end of 1970, Church Farm decided not to continue in the 71 season. And somewhere along the line, I'd spoken to Derek and said, look, George is available. There's a workshop space down at Church Farm at Pagham available, and you can have it rent-free. I said, I'm coming. I'll be over. I think I was in Belfast at the time. And George is one of these amazing technicians, engineers, mechanics, whichever term fits. And in 1970, I had a very small budget, and I really had to finish every race to get the prize money to go on to the next race, to get your start money, to get your prize. So it was one of those years. And in 71, Formula 2 was extremely competitive. And also, it was the first year that a young Ron Dennis entered motorsport as a team owner with Rondell Racing. And they were running almost the factory run BT36 Brabham. And I had a BT30 with some 36 mods on it. A very competitive year. It was also the year that March introduced the 721, which was the first March monocoque, which was Ronnie was driving, then Niki Lauda, Jean-Pierre Jousseau, Jarier, God knows how many other people. Highly competitive year, so limit on what we could afford. And part of the budget constraints was, well, who would we get to build the engine? And George said, I'll do it. Well, what about the gearbox? I'll do it. What about the chassis? Yeah, I'll do that as well. And what made George such a fantastic person to work with was that he would take an FVA engine apart, do all the work, and he would recognize when you needed something attending to that was beyond what he could do engineering-wise. Gearbox, chassis. I mean, where are those guys today? I suspect many of them are out there, but they work within the context. Your job description is that's what you do, and you don't do any more.
Yeah, you become a damper specialist or
whatever.
Or whatever, that's it. But
he didn't have to do this at Church Farm Racing because they had a sufficient budget to send their engines to Brian Hart, the gearboxes to Hewland or whoever else they were engaging. But George was one of those people. So we would drive through Europe, and that time it was a transit and a trailer, share the driving, 4 hours on, 4 hours off, leave at maybe 9:30 in the morning and drive until maybe 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. I mean, going to Jarama, just outside Madrid, was a 2 and a bit day drive. I think it was very good for me because I learned to appreciate what I was being given the opportunity to do. And I didn't have a pop at Lance in particular because it's not his fault he was born into the circumstances he was, and his family have done what they need to do to get Lance to where he is. But I think there are lots of youngsters in maybe a national level racing and single seater racing who have got maybe a lot of material items too soon in their lives, and maybe, you know, the motivation and the drive can be affected by that. So I think what I had was an appreciation of what I was doing and a focus on what I would need to do to get to where I wanted to be.
And you're also finding out about the real world.
It was a real world in those days. I mean, you're only allowed to take £50 on every trip because you had currency control regulations. And I mean, it was a lot more difficult. We didn't have social media. We didn't have mobile phones. You know, that we survived. And it's as a byline, one of my good friends and co-commentators, Jack Nicholls, who now is Radio 5 Live's Formula One commentator, a number of years ago, seriously turned around and said, John, I don't know how you ever got by without, you know, internet and laptop and whatever. And it's just, that's how times is changing.
So you didn't have a team of 80 people back in the garage in Pagham on laptops calling strategy?
No, they were servicing the caravans in Church Farm Caravan Park, cleaning out the dunnies in the caravans.
I'm going to jump to the Roger Penske era now. We had a really great conversation at the Hall of Fame about Roger Penske. Do you think Roger's efforts in Formula One are perhaps under-recognised in terms of what he brought to the sport, his professionalism, the way he ran the team?
I mean, what Roger, I think, brought to Formula One was it was a level of presentation initially, and part of the Penske image has been presentation, but also very strong engineering as well, and picking drivers that fit into the Penske ideal of what the team is. The team is not about, let's say, one superstar, prima donna or whatever. It's about a team. And when Roger entered Formula One at the end of 74 and Jeff Ferris designed the car, Mark Donohue was the family member within the Penske empire. So it was quite a step for Mark and for Penske to come out of what they've been successful with in the States, albeit that they'd raced in Europe with the Ferrari 512M at Le Mans and other international events. So coming over, establishing a base in down in Poole and in Dorset, Heinz Hofer was the person that Roger gave all the authority to, the delegation to. And Heinz was an outstanding person in every respect and a great team principal. So Roger brought lots of things that Formula One was beginning to be aware of, but I think in terms of the presentation and what he expected his cars to look like in terms of performance as well as just the image, that was something, I don't know whether it's right to say or not, but I think maybe someone like Ron Dennis might have been influenced by what Roger was doing in terms of the visuals of the car. So
this actually links to a question we've got from a reader, Steve Salusky. My first experience reading, viewing you was 76 when you were with Penske. Do you think F1 should find a way to promote entrants like Penske now?
Well, I think Formula One has to find a solution to the issue that it's ended up in that it's so ridiculously expensive.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily expensive as well. And I would love to see more of what I enjoyed in my career in Formula One from the middle or early 70s through to the early 80s, wherein a guy called Frank something or other, what was his name? Frank, what do you call the bloke from Sly? Williams, Frank Williams. And started up, had a car in the late 60s, yeah. Then had the disaster of Piers Courage, struggled a long time to get back into Formula One. But the fact is, that struggle has ended up with now one of the greatest teams in Formula One,
yeah.
With a legacy of world championships for team and drivers. Hopefully, some point in the future, the team can get back to that level. But I think it'll be very difficult because right now, Formula One is principally dominated by manufacturers. And if you haven't got direct manufacturer support and the consequent financial budgets and support to go along with it, it's very hard to see how the likes of Williams or Force India or Toro Rosso or Sauber or whoever, even Haas. And Haas is a good example of a team that has come in, albeit with a great deal of background support from Ferrari. And even my fellow countrymen, diddly eye, die, die, little Darby O'Gill and the little folk called Eddie Jordan. I mean, where are the Eddie Jordans? I mean, there are people, I suspect, in various levels of motorsport, probably now F2, who would love to make the step from F2 into Formula One, but there's no money.
There's no chassis either. We talk about customer engines so much, but Frank started with a customer chassis. So yes. Many other manufacturers started with a customer chassis. F1 chassis, they have a year. They're Mayflies, they have a year, and yes. Then they're out. Wouldn't that be an easy solution if they were allowed to sell the chassis and someone else could come in and use them the following year?
It's one solution. I would still prefer to see a team's identity be in their chassis rather than having as you have an IndyCar, sure. For example, you've got a single chassis. I think Formula One needs that demarcation between where IndyCar is and where Formula One should be. But if you think back to the 70s, it was relatively simple by today's standards to engage a young engineer, Patrick Head being the case in point, with Frank Williams. And he brought with him young ideas, and he was very quick to embrace the benefits of ground effect to very good effect. You had John Barnard at McLaren, Gordon Murray, obviously, because Gordon's period at Brabham from 72, really 73, all the way forward, and the BT49 and consequent ground effect cars mean, Gordon is one of Formula One's, well, he's a genius, he is a hero, and it needs people like that. And I would like to think there are still young engineers out there who would have enough imagination and capacity to dream of what they would be allowed to do if we had. It's not so much the chassis itself, that's relatively, I think, straightforward. It's the engineering around it, the engines or the power units and the aerodynamics that need to be redressed.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the era of customer chassis and absolutely loved the fact there were privateer teams at the back, like Hexagon, for example, running year-old cars. But if you did that now, you still need 200 people to run the flipping things because they're so complex. I mean, how many people did you have working on the Hexagon Brabham? Well, Four, five, six?
We went to a race, maybe 10 people in total, maybe not even that. And you could do that. Paul Michaels acquired a BT42. Alan McCall was engaged and he engineered the car, made some changes to it. I think with Frank Swanston, George Zacharias, Preston, I'm trying to think of the other names, probably less than 10 people would go to a Grand Prix, and that would include the transportation. I don't think we're going to go back to those days, but I think that some of the cost cutting that Formula One should consider would, is it necessary to have such a massive support team? And while I don't want to see engineering become a customer car formula in total, but I think there are areas where there could be much more cost cutting, partly within whether you think a hybrid power unit is the way to go. I personally not a big fan, but I understand why manufacturers like it. But again, we're thinking about manufacturers and not thinking about the user, the person that wants to sit down, who wants to be entertained. And I feel strongly that that's the area that Formula One needs to address. And I want to see people getting excited. And I want to see them focusing on drivers and not focusing on a driver because he's in a Mercedes or a Ferrari or a Red Bull or whatever it happens to be. I want them to follow the drivers. There will always be an element of brand support, but it should never be subjugated, or drivers should never be subjugated by engines or power units or teams.
There has been a shift, though. I remember in the mid-90s, as a child, sorry, everyone.
But I was that old.
Listen, fatal mistake to grow up.
Well, I remember I was no plans supporting Williams. It was irrelevant who was in the car, because it changed year on year, but I was following Williams as a team rather than who was in the car. So there must have been a shift at some point when the teams became more important than the drivers. I'm not sure when that would have been, but...
Maybe because, as many fans would do, if you saw... the archetypical British team was Williams. So for you, it was more important to have the team winning because it's a British team. It's a bit like watching maybe football. You don't give a sod about who the players are as long as it's England winning. I tend to have a slightly different perspective, but then, you know, I'm younger than you, so that's what the younger generations will be feeling.
He's old before his time. Yeah. I'm gonna pause and Mercedes-Benz shop online. You'll be able to find anything from picnic hampers, barbecue sets, sunglasses and travel bags. We believe there's a sale on right now, so if you're quick and you go to www.shop.mercedes-benz.com, you'll be able to see all sorts of stuff, including some cars for sale. But yeah, picnic hampers, barbecue sets, sunglasses and travel bags. So there you go. I'm going to move on to some reader questions now, because we have piles of them. So, and you guys feel free to jump in at any point. But the first one, I think, do you know what? We're going to have to talk about the beard, John. We've got to get this one out of the way. So I'm going to put all three questions that we've had, or that you've, I mean, they're more than three, but we've got a short list of three. Were you faster without the beard? Would you regrow your beard in the interest of historical accuracy if offered a test in a BT44? And did you dread having to shave your beard off? And is it true that Roger Penske did not recognise you the next morning? Thanks to Matt, Indine Rally, Paul Punter, one of our contributors, and Tony Duran. So,
first question,
faster without the beard.
Makes no difference whatsoever. I mean, a beard was something I had when I was a young guy. And I did shave it off, actually, in about 1968 for about a year, and then I regrew it again. Maybe it was an identity thing. It was nothing to do with speed.
Well, this Paul Punter, a contributor, he's obviously pitching a story, yeah, exactly, isn't he? Yeah. If you were offered a test in a BT44, would you regrow it?
Well, it wouldn't be the same because in 1974, the beard was a strong, rich, you know, chocolatey brown.
A hipster beard.
It was a full beard. I mean, it was a beard. And today, I mean, if I was to deign to let it grow again, I would make me look even more mature or elegant or barking mad than I am. So it wouldn't be the same. It would be the same amount of hair, I suspect, but you wouldn't recognize it because it would look like anybody of my age would have a white beard.
We'll stick with elegant, I think. Did Roger Penske recognize you the next morning?
What happened after Austria, we flew back. Roger Heinz and myself flew back and we stayed overnight at one of the Heathrow hotels because Roger was flying out the following morning and we just wanted to have a quick, you know, post-race, whatever, summary. And when I got to my room, went into the bathroom, got the razor out, shaved it off, actually that night. And because 76 had been a particularly hot summer, you know, everybody was well suntanned, and all of a sudden I had a big white patch around my chin. Anyway, I came down to breakfast in the morning, and I was down before Roger or Heinz and sitting there in the coffee shop. And Roger walked in, and I remember his voice saying, "Where's Watson? Where's Watson?" I said, "Roger, over here," but I didn't indicate. "Where is he?" And he, I think, was probably more surprised that I had taken the beard off with such haste. I wanted to shave it. I'd had enough. By that stage, you know, the novelty had worn off. But it was more an issue about, we had sort of had an agreement that when we won our first Grand Prix, I would then shave the beard. And the reason why maybe I didn't shave it prior to the 76 season was that I suppose everybody would say, "Oh, well, Roger told me to do it." You know, Roger doesn't like, you know, he wants everybody in the team to have maybe you might describe as an Ivy League appearance because it went with the whole sense of how the car should look, the appearance of the team, presentation of the car. And here's this sort of 30-odd or 20-year-old hippie type, longish hair, beard. Where does this fit into the Penske sort of idiom of what a racing team should look like? So I was quite happy to shave it off. It was no stress, believe me.
Okay, 1977. This is a question from Charles Norman. The Brabham BT45 Alpha looked very strong, and you drove superbly at Silverstone and Dijon, looking odds on to win both. It's been reported that the car was very fuel thirsty and ran low towards the end of both races. Was that correct?
In Dijon, I don't fully understand what happened. I don't know if anybody does to this day, but the Brabham, the Alfa Romeo engine was a lovely engine to drive. Mm. But it was probably more fuel thirsty than a DFE. So the start-up weight for car per car would have been higher. And what happened in Dijon was in the final lap, down at the far end of the circuit, hairpin bend, coming out of it, the engine just went, and Mario, who had been, you know, we had been racing for the lead for the best part of, what, two-thirds or whatever of the race, he didn't need to be invited. So he literally got the acceleration out of that hairpin bend while I was stuttering out of it, and once he got ahead, then there was only three corners, and I wasn't able to get back at him. So that was a huge disappointment to everybody in the Brabham Alfa Romeo team, not least of all to me, because it would have been the first victory for Alfa Romeo as a Formula One entrant or engine supplier all the way back to the 50s when they were running the 159s.
Yeah,
and then the race following was at Silverstone. Had another fuel issue, which I think was a different issue. That was to do maybe with the flaps and the fuel valves. I think maybe one of them had been fitted incorrectly, and it was the fuel. There was tons of fuel in the car, it wasn't getting into the collector, and therefore I had to come in. We refueled it and went back out again, and after another 10 or 12 laps, the situation repeated itself. So at that point, I think the car was retired. So there were fuel issues, but different ones.
Okay. This is a question that I should have submitted, but then I remembered I'm actually hosting this, so I can ask whatever the hell I like.
At least
the fan car. I think we're all in many ways are obsessed with the fan car.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that the car, or maybe Bernie withdrew the car to save Formula One. But this is almost impossible question to answer. But with your sage or soothsayer hat on, where would Formula One have gone if the fan car was allowed? It hadn't been banned.
Well, I think that, first of all, Gordon Murray designed the fan car around the principle that we can't do a ground effect car with the BT46 because it's the triangular shape monocoque didn't permit it.
Yeah.
And the part of the reason the triangular shape was because that's a very strong structure in terms of torsional rigidity. But also the flat 12 Alfa Romeo engine, as with the flat 12 Ferrari engine, was not a suitable candidate for a ground effect car.
Sure.
So Gordon looked around and saw what Chaparral had done, and while they used an auxiliary engine to deliver the fan power,
it was a snowmobile engine, wasn't it, in the Chaparral, if I seem to remember. It was a Kawasaki snowmobile.
I'm not sure what it was, a snowmobile engine. Sorry,
yeah.
So what Gordon did, and this is where Gordon is exceptionally clever, and his lateral views on engineering and how can we come up with an answer to a problem, they organized a fan that was driven directly from the engine, and the radiator was placed above that. So the idea was the fan would suck air through the radiator and somehow it would get exhausted out the back. And of course, it was all considered by such notables as Colin Chapman and his principal, Lieutenant Mario Andretti. So they were, when they saw the fan car in Anderstorp, they went nuts. They went apoplectic because they realized that what gave the fan car an advantage over a ground effect car was that the fan was driven at gear speed as opposed to a ground effect car, which is road speed. And in Anderstorp, a lot of the corners were parabolic corners and there weren't high speed corners. So the level of ground effect that the Lotus had in those corners was significantly less than it would have had in high speed corners. And the Brabham benefited from running the gearing that you're in. So sucking down, in other words, 10,000 RPM or 12,000 RPM in second gear was getting the same amount of suction that it would get at the same RPM in sixth gear. So the circuit was actually probably an ideal circuit for the fan car. And Nicky won the race. And I mean, Mario, I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions, but some of the lies that he and Chapman were purporting were just, I mean, outrageous. I mean, remember, Mario said, that car's throwing rocks. It's going to hit somebody in the head and kill them.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you then? So they wanted the thing banned. They wanted it banned there, but Bernie had brought the car. There was no... Well, you couldn't convert the car overnight. And I think that Ken Tyrrell was standing on the table spitting bullets, literally, as Ken used to have froth jobs. Teddy Mayer was going and Chapman was getting, you know, he was doing, and Colin was pretty, a very clever guy. He understood what was going on. He knew the danger that Formula One would get into if it followed what Gordon had done. And whether it would have been possible to have fitted a fan to a DFE in the way that it was attached to the flat 12 engine probably wouldn't have been as easy because the flat 12 engine, every 180 degrees, so the intakes are on the outside of the engine, whereas the 90 degree V8, it's on the top. So it might not have been quite a simpler thing to do, but I'm sure teams would not have taken a long time, and Chapman in particular, to find a way to install a fan on already in a ground effect car. So you'd have had cars with a cornering performance, which would have certainly outstripped the circuits that we were racing on at the time. And you've seen as the consequence of what happened at Imola in 94, how all of a sudden you had a massive rethinking about circuit safety, runoff areas, and consequently the construction of cars and driver safety. It would have been an interesting exercise. It would have probably raised cost thresholds significantly, and you would have had cars that would have been literally like slot cars. I mean, they'd have been cornering at ridiculously high speeds for the technology. So the structures that the cars were built from, aluminium and steel, would not have been sufficient to allow you maybe to exploit the full potential. And that's where carbon fiber then would have been, it might have come forward a bit earlier, but the importance of carbon fiber was not the material, it was the use of the material. And that's what John Barnard pioneered.
Did it require a massively different approach to drive from the 46 to the 46B with a fan?
Well, the first thing was in the paddock when they were waiting to go out for practice or qualifying, And Bernie would lean into the cockpit and say, "Don't rev the engine, don't rev the engine." "What do you say, Bernie? Don't rev the engine." And of course, he had his, because he had to lean forward, his toes were under the side of the monocoque. So every time the toe nipped his toes, "Don't rev the engine." You couldn't make it up. So you could sit in the car, rev the engine, you could feel the car physically
dropping,
coming down. I think that the art of using the fan car was to enter slow, exit quick. In other words, get the engine, don't go in a trailing throttle, you know, doing all this sort of stuff and then getting on the throttle late. Ideally, you'd come into the corner, brake slightly earlier, pick up the throttle and get the fan to do what it was meant to do, to give you the initial bite at the entry to the corner and then nail it all the way through. So that was the slight difference. And compared to a conventional, forget about a ground effect car, because nobody knew what a ground effect car was like to drive until Lotus rocked up with it, initially in 77 with the 78, then in 78 with the 79. So we were running conventional aerodynamics, front rear wings, and a couple of teams, I think Penske did flirt with having plexics, little glass deflectors on the front of the nose. McLaren, I think, tried it. Certainly Gordon had tried it in the BT44s. But not to the degree that we got to with ground effects.
And last thing on the BT46B, did you sandbag quite a bit during practice?
I think we may have had a fair amount of fuel on board because, again, we didn't want to raise the temperature. The already fever-driven principals, Chapman, Tyrrell, Mayer, I don't know who was at Ferrari, it was a Figueri, you know, going apoplectic. So it was we were asked to bear in mind that this is a very sensitive situation we're in. Bernie's having to fight, you know, from the back foot. He has got no allies. I mean, it was very close to a point, I understand, where there could have been a fracture within the team's group, the FOC or whatever they were called, or FIA, whatever, FICA, whatever they called themselves in those days. And Bernie did the right thing. He said, "Look, I can't change the car. I've got the two cars here. Let me run them. And thereafter, I'll take all the stuff off." And what gave me, actually, not in so much in Sweden, but in the French Grand Prix that followed, immense pleasure was to take the bog standard BT46 and end up in pole position for the French Grand Prix. But the Lotus in the race pissed past us, so whatever. But we got the satisfaction of, you know, giving them a little bit of what they thought they were going to get.
What a great picture, that paint.
There you are, Mario.
I don't remember seeing that on
there. It was just fun. Yeah. But you know, it meant a lot to me, and it meant a lot to Gordon and to Bernie, I think.
Right, we're going to jump to the McLaren era now with a question from Ricardo Turcato. It's a similar question around innovations in Formula One. How was the sensation when you drove the carbon fibre McLaren for the first time?
Well, when I drove it for the first time, actually, was at the launch of the car at Silverstone, and it was a horrible, bloody wet day. And I think, actually, I'm not sure, but I don't think we even had the aero tunnels under the car. It was just simply, we just rolled it out. And the only difference that I noticed was that how unyielding carbon fiber is as a material compared to aluminium. Yeah. So it was a matter of you had to tuck your elbows in when you were driving rather than having them slightly out. If you hit an aluminium tub with your elbow, it hurt, but you got over it. If you hit the carbon fiber tub with your elbow, it hurt for a long time. It is so unyielding as a material in terms just of the amount it gives. Even with an elbow, aluminium will give a small amount. That's why wings don't fall off aeroplanes, you know, when they bend over an arc of 30 or 40 feet. It's got a flexibility, but carbon fiber principally, in the case of the tub and the McLaren, was not designed to yield. It was designed to give you a much greater rigidity and therefore more accuracy in terms of the chassis performance, but also repeatability. And just the way that John designed the tub, he designed it in conjunction with, out in Salt Lake City, what was the company name? What's it gone?
I can't know.
Anyway, they used the material in the manner in which it was intended to be used. Whereas other teams, I think, jumped on the carbon fiber bandwagon and kind of maybe designed it in a similar way to how they would have designed an aluminium car.
yeah.
which was a mistake.
Yeah.
And a number of drivers did suffer injuries because of maybe a misuse of the material rather than fully understanding it.
Yeah. And of course, you had your accident at Monza
yeah.
in 81.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel your life was saved by carbon fibre at that point?
I think there's a very strong argument to say I could have had a much more serious injury.
Yeah.
Potentially, you might have lost your life. I've never thought back and said, oh, thank God I didn't die that day. I just stepped out of the car, walked back to the pit, said, sorry, guys, it's a bit of a mess. And move forward.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, John Barnard, and John's got a biography or an autobiography coming out very shortly. And this clearly is a significant part of it because it illustrated the value and the quality of the material and the fact that I was able to step out of the car, mm-hmm. totally uninjured, minus the engine gearbox, which ended up going across the track. And I think Michele Alboreto clipped it, and he then had an accident further down the road. Mm. The technology that John introduced and then became the norm in Formula One was a landmark for our transition in Formula One engineering, safety, everything. And I had one big accident, which was obviously televised, but maybe more to the point, and sadly, the late Andrea De Cesaris, who was in his first Formula One year with me. Andrea had about 16 or 17 accidents through the course of the season. Mm-hmm. And the car was repaired and okay, did a lot of damage to suspension and to bodywork, but never got injured. No. And I think that was the transition in terms of what the material could provide for consistency, continuity, safety, rigidity, and particularly in the era of ground effects.
Yeah.
How can you get that torsional rigidity with light weight?
Yeah.
And that's what it gave. You couldn't really achieve that with a lightweight aluminium and a traditional chassis. If you got the stiffness, then you had weight. So the carbon fiber factor was the one that gave us light weight and great torsional strength.
Okay.
And of course, you have the honor of scoring the first Grand Prix victory for a carbon fiber Formula One car.
Yep.
Silverstone in 81. I think that was the last Grand Prix I paid to watch. I think everyone I've been to since I've had a press
sneaking
pass.
Under the fence, yeah.
No, more I've had a press bar, but I was at the outside of Woodcote that day, and one of the things I saw early on was you managing to avoid the Villeneuve Alan Jones shunt and your teammate Mr. De Cesaris, who was further from the accident, actually getting involved in it. It was a very passionate day. I think it was the first British Grand Prix driver to win a race since James, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And from 1977 to 1970.
So, but I mean, I remember there was a fantastic atmosphere towards the end of the race as you were catching Arnoux and so on. What are your recollections of the day?
Well, the incident at Woodcote was an accident waiting to happen because Gilles was in the Ferrari, which
was a Routemaster bus.
One of the worst Ferraris probably ever raced. I mean, where Gilles, I felt, shone, was in a car that was a much poorer car than the competition. And he just drove the wheels off him, and in this case he was going through the chicane, and it was going to happen one way or the other, and Alan was close enough behind him that when it did happen the amount of blue smoke went up. Alan got disorientated, didn't know where he was. I think he nudged into the Ferrari. Fortunately, I was six car lengths back, and I was looking through the corner watching what was going on ahead of me, so I was able to get on the brakes, slow down, and avoided contact with the two ahead of me. In the process, the engine had stalled because it had to brake very heavily, and I was focusing and trying to see where I was going. And Andrea, who was behind me, who was doing what any novice or young guy would do, he was driving, looking at my gearbox, not looking through the corner. And that's what you get with maturity. You learn with age. So you shouldn't be looking directly at the car ahead of you. You should be looking a little bit beyond it. And Andrea saw my car almost at a standstill. He turned sharp left to avoid hitting me, and had his own accident. So once the smoke cleared and I had still a little bit of momentum, I got the car back into gear, lifted the clutch, put the fuel pump on, bump, 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 and off it went. And, you know, I'd passed, I think, a couple of cars before I got up to the tail of Alan. My car was very good on the day, and I was looking forward to getting past both of those two, but where it was going to happen, it's hard to tell, because you know the speed of the turbo Ferrari was always a disadvantage for a DFE. You're quicker around the corners, you're later on brakes, but that thing only had to squirt down the straight, as Gilles did very successfully two races earlier in Jarama, and even earlier than that in Monte Carlo, where he won both those races in a car that was a poor car, but he used it to full effect. So getting past Alan may not have been so difficult, but getting past Gilles was going to be a struggle. So he made it easier, in effect, by taking himself and Alan out.
Right, we're running out of time, chaps, I'm afraid, but there are a few more questions from our readers I'd like to go through. We actually stole the last two questions from some readers, and I didn't credit them. So thank you to Jamie Smith and Dave number 7 for your two questions there. Let's jump to Ray in Toronto. Your recollections of the end of 83 when Renault-Prost had their falling out and he suddenly became available on the market. Were you out of contract or were you bought out?
Well, it was the normal scenario. You know, you kept dangling by the team as to what their future thoughts were for 84. And in South Africa, the race was on a Saturday. And on the way back to the airport or on the plane back, someone in the team said, "Oh, suppose we might have to talk to you about next year then." I said, "Yeah, do it now if you like." Got back into London on Sunday morning. Alain Prost had flown back to France and arrived in Paris at the same time and was, I believe, summoned to the Regie, the Renault headquarters, and apparently was fired. Reasons for which I've never heard formally explained, but there are lots of very unpleasant suggestions. But I can't talk about
tell
them.
Tell us more, no. John. Go on, years ago. It's fine.
Anyway, whatever reason, Alan got the P45. And he then immediately called, I think, John Hogan at Philip Morris, because he still had an association from his McLaren days in 1980, and said, "You know, I've been fired. Can you get me in at Ferrari?" And John, I believe, this is all hearsay, said, "No, Ferrari seats are confirmed, but we've got a seat available at McLaren." And Alan thought, "Well, you've got Nicky and John." And it was explained to him that Nicky has a contract for 1984. John hasn't, and we would like to talk to you. So it was a no-brainer, to be honest. I mean, as much as I lost out, and I've said this on a number of occasions, if I'd been in the situation of the sponsor and the team, I'd have done the same thing, because what McLaren had at that time are two, in terms of age, senior drivers, and at some point one or both would be deciding to go off and go fishing or go flying airplanes or whatever, and they would then have to turn around and go into the market and buy at the top of the market an appropriate replacement. And Alain was the gift horse, because obviously there would have been some compensation from Renault, and therefore he would have been an inexpensive acquisition. But more importantly, he represented the future, because as an outstanding, you know, potential world champion and Grand Prix winner, it's a no-brainer. So the deal was done, I think, very quickly. And I remember getting a call from Nicky, on the Monday or the Tuesday, to say, "Be careful, Alain is talking to Philip Morris, talking to McLaren." Because Nicky didn't want Alain in the team. He knew that he represented a challenge that meant he might have to raise his game. He thought, having me as a teammate, he thought he could control me, which, of course, you know, let him think whatever he likes. As it turns out, I never got the chance to find out. And Alain got the opportunity, and he went on to win his first world championship in 1985. So for McLaren and for Marlboro, it was clearly the right decision. Where maybe for me it was disappointing was that I didn't have control over my future. And I think every driver would like to have that opportunity to say whether they wish to continue and have the chance to negotiate, or to turn up and say, "Look, I've done 10 years, 151 Grand Prix, and I think I'm still alive. I'm prepared to say now is the time to stop."
But you never really thought what? I mean, you left the team just as it was about to win three straight world titles.
Yes.
You never thought what if?
Well, I can do, but of course, what if is only what if. You don't know what would have happened. And I mean, Nicky won the championship by half a point in 1984. What if I'd been in the other car? Would he have won it by half a point, or would I have won it, or would he have won it by a country mile? I don't know. Those are ifs, ands, or buts, so I don't really go there because it's a hypothetical. So all I can reflect upon is what I did do rather than what might have been.
I'm going to actually jump back to a what if, I'm afraid. But this one's Anthony Jenkins. Question from Anthony Jenkins. Thank you, Anthony. Just how good was your countryman Tommy Byrne? Did he have world champion level in him? I know you've been asked before, yep, but it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on Tommy.
I think Tommy is an illustration of a driver who had natural ability. You could see that in his Formula 4 days and Formula 3 days. I think where he lacked was in self-discipline. And when he drove a McLaren, he did a really outstanding job at a test at Silverstone. Drove the car at that point quicker around Silverstone than anybody had ever done before. So that marked him out as being a guy who'd got natural ability, but I think it was the lack of discipline. And possibly also when he got to drive, I think it was the Theodore,
Theodore.
Which was not, by any stretch of the imagination, the best car. He then probably, rather than sucking it up and doing the best job he could and not maybe being vocal about it, do what he could with what he had and hope that people might recognize that. But the amazing thing for me is that I don't think any Formula One team took it any further. I think once he's at the end of 83 or whenever it was, I don't think anybody in Formula One had a discussion with Tommy Byrne. I don't know why, but maybe they saw the pluses and they saw other elements which they thought might be negatives, and the calculation said maybe the negatives aren't, or there's too many negatives, not enough pluses. You can have a guy who is ill-disciplined as long as he delivers. I mean, there's been a legacy of those drivers in Formula One, and some of them have been world champions, but they've got enough self-discipline when it counts to do what they have to do to win either a race or win a world championship. I don't think Tommy had that. But whether he was educational enough, I don't know. Mm. It's a shame, because that level of natural ability and talent, it's a shame to see it lost. But it was in his own hands, I'm afraid.
Sure. Is it a kind of a related question, actually, from Oscar Matsarath? Thank you, Oscar, for your question. You once said during your one-off race for McLaren in 85 at Brands, you followed Ayrton Senna through Dingledale and couldn't believe the things he was doing with the car. Do you think he was markedly better than Prost and Lauda? One question I'd like to add to that. Senna realised he needed discipline, didn't he? Couldn't rely on his talent. What? Give us an overview of that 85, following him in 85, and then what Senna managed to, how he managed to turn his sort of his discipline around.
Well, Ayrton was obviously, being Brazilian, he was probably from the more emotional side of the racing driver than maybe some from more, well, you might call them Germanic backgrounds. So, I mean, 85 at the race of European Grand Prix, or whatever it was called. That brief moment when Senna in the Lotus at Brands Hatch was just, in qualifying, untouchable, just stunning to watch. And at that brief moment through Dingledale and up into Dingledale Corner, I'd never seen a Grand Prix driver do what Ayrton was doing in the Lotus. Mm. It was just mind-boggling. And the speed he was carrying, and the commitment. I mean, there was no margin for error, but that was totally within his grasp. It wasn't something he was doing, you know, like a one-lap wonder. He was truly gifted in the skill of qualifying, and I've never seen a driver, I think, since, who's illustrated that commitment and that ability. And I've often wondered why, or what it was that he had. Yeah. I once asked him a question, and I got a slightly ratty answer from him. I'll not go into it now. That's for another podcast in about 5 years' time.
Yep.
So I just thought, there's nobody I have seen. And Alain, I was sharing in the same McLaren car as Alain was in. And Keke, Mansell was in a Williams.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, was Keke in the Williams as well?
Keke was in a Williams 85, yeah.
I mean, just the guy was a genius behind the wheel of a race car. And that genius then, when it moved forward, and when Alain and Ayrton were together in the McLaren, they both achieved similar goals, but by different routes. And I think it made Alan an outstanding competitor. But the raw speed that Senna possessed, I've not really seen that, I think, in the same areas that I've seen it with Senna.
Sure. Is anyone today you see has that raw speed? I mean, we talked about Verstappen before went on air.
It's Max, obviously, is a guy who's got phenomenal car control skills, and particularly overtaking, braking. He does things, if you think back, it was Japan last year. He has got that extra spatial awareness when he is making these decisions. And I would look at the two people, and I think Ayrton was a highly intelligent individual. I mean, not just in a race car, just intellectually and in intelligence-wise. And I think Max is probably somebody who hasn't got that similar degree, but he is streetwise, like you can't believe, behind the wheel of a race car. And it's all basically very easy for him.
Yeah.
I think he needs a further education. I think the team could do better with that talent and helping him to understand that winning a race is more about coming first on the last lap than trying to win it on the opening lap.
Sure.
But he's got a prodigious talent, and I would like to see that talent being better educated than the team are currently doing. I think the team are using his talent to make up for some of the deficiencies within their package.
Sure.
To the detriment, and I say this with great sadness, because I think Danny Ricciardo is an outstanding racer and a great race driver. When you get a team focusing on a driver because they think he might get a better result, rather than giving both drivers their full attention, I sometimes feel that's a mistake.
Sure.
One other thing we chatted about before we came on air, and we are running short of time, so it doesn't give you too long to rant, but the subject of halos on Formula One cockpits. John Watson, you have 2 minutes.
This is also a question.
A halo is something should be above your head on a Christmas card. I think if drivers are so paranoid about losing their lives, and it's an awful thing to say. No driver wants to lose his life as a racing driver. I know some people in the media think, or maybe people in the audience think, maybe the ultimate destiny for a racing driver is to die behind the wheel. Well, I don't subscribe to that. But I don't feel that the halo is the answer. And I think if drivers are really intent on ensuring that there's nothing that will ever occur, a wheel getting loose, a suspension getting loose, a nose or bodywork getting loose, there is only one solution, in my view, to ensure that that will not lead to a fatality, and that is to end up with a Formula One car with a cockpit not dissimilar to what an LMP1 car would have. So it's a fully enclosed, a bit like if you look at some of the power racing boats, the hydroplanes, they've almost got a self-contained ejector seat pod.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I can say. I think the halo or the bubble screen, I mean, Karsten made a bubble screen for a Protoss Formula 2 car in 1967. Yeah. And they had to cut a slot in the damn thing so the driver could see where he was going.
Yeah.
It's not the solution. And I think if drivers feel sufficiently strongly about it, they should then insist on having something entirely different and properly engineered, thought out, and executed.
Or stop being a driver and go off and be an accountant.
Well, accept it for what it is.
It's very interesting. I mean, one of our readers, A.S. Gilbert, has phrased this really well, actually. He says, to me, it looks disturbingly under-evolved. That there is a danger there, isn't it? That it may be rushed.
Well, I'm not an engineer. I don't know the figures. I don't know what research has been done on it. But it's not in my view, it's not the solution. And the solution should be, as I say, a fully enclosed cockpit like a racing hydroplane, or similar to an LMP1 car. Obviously, we wouldn't have the full width bodywork. But that's the only solution I understand, from my limited knowledge, that would provide the kind of assurances that I think contemporary Grand Prix drivers are looking for. And I'm not persuaded that every driver believes a halo is the answer. But I think because of pressures within the FIA now, that if there were to be another incident, Henry Surtees or Justin Wilson, I put the Jules Bianchi thing aside, because that was that was a separate issue, and that could still occur, halo or no halo. I would like a better research program to be initiated to think of a solution that would work in my limited knowledge and my limited engineering skill. I don't think the halo is the answer.
Okay. Two final questions that will test your memory. This is from Chris Hall. Whilst on the subject of Rouen, this is because he asked another question, but we haven't got time for that one, I'm afraid, Chris. But Rouen, was the chicane used in 1971 before or after the Gressel curve at the back of the circuit? Enthusiasts have been seeking the answer for years, and no one seems to have the definite answer, so I thought I'd ask someone who was there.
Certainly in 1970, there was nothing. It was just the raw circuit. And Rouen is a fantastic racetrack, a proper racetrack. In 71, I think it was still as it was. But then I raced there the next time, I think it was 74. And there was a chicane somewhere. But it's obviously, in fact, we used a revised circuit. It was a shorter circuit. We didn't end up using that long autoroute bit. So that was a revised circuit. And I...
Do you remember where the chicane was? Was it before or after?
Haven't got a clue.
Chris, Chris.
Sorry about that. It's called...
We'll look it up.
No, no, sorry. The reason is it's called Alzheimer's Light.
Light. L-I-T-E.
Might be if you like the beer.
Right, okay. This was an interesting one because I wasn't actually aware that you drove the Active Williams in...
Yes, end of 93, yeah.
Peter Buchavan, how smooth is the ride? There we go. How smooth was the ride?
Well,
tell us about that car.
Once a late racing driver described his Formula One car, it rides like a Packard. Now, the question is to you, Nick. The question is to you, Simon. Which driver described his Formula One car had a ride like a Packard?
It's got to be a US driver. It's not Mario.
You said late.
Yes.
Donahue.
I'll put you out of your misery because we're running out of time. Peter Revson. That particular incarnation at FW, was it 12, 13, 14? I'm not sure.
What was that, 13, was it in 93? Or I'm not sure.
It is probably the most remarkable Formula One car I've driven outside of a W125 Mercedes-Benz. Because at Paul Ricard, the surface is very smooth, so you didn't really... But what it did was it had continuity, consistency of ride height control. So the aerodynamics and its efficiency was always consistent. But that car had power steering, power brakes, traction control. I don't want to demean what Nigel did in 1992 or Alain did in 93. But clearly they had a car with a significant advantage over their competitors. And McLaren kind of got close, but it was only at the end of the year and after the experience of the Lamborghini engine, when they extended the wheelbase and they got then the benefits of the ground effect or the active suspension, that they actually closed up and maybe overtook Williams. It was just a remarkable car. And as Jochen Mass, Allard Kalf, myself, Derek Daly, maybe one or two others, drove it and just jumped into it. And the car all you had to do was sit there and hang on. I think Jochen went flat out through scene because the Germans do that sort of zing. But the car was so good, it just went flat out through scene.
Wonderful. So who was quickest then that day? Come on, John.
I think, I don't know, I suspect Jochen would have been because he was quick through scene.
Yeah. Right, do you know what, we are going to have to wrap this up. There's been a wonderful podcast. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. I enjoyed
much,
it very much. Thank you.
And thanks to Simon and thanks to Jack. Keep subscribing to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. Enjoy the website as well. I have to thank Alan Hyde as well, who's behind the camera and behind the mic as well. So thanks to him. Stay tuned. We've got some great guests coming up. And thanks again, John. That was a magnificent podcast.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.